its current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us here today. Later on this hour, we've got Lansing mayoral candidate Harold Lehman. We talk about college fight songs, the best college fight songs in America. And we've got live music throughout the program here today from the Brooklyn-based duo Mahogany. They are in town to play the Broad Art Museum's first anniversary celebration, and we will talk with them later in the hour. The debate over electric choice in Michigan has intensified the last few days. Last week, Public Sector Consultants, a Lansing-based media advocacy organization, released a study suggesting that electric customers in several states that offer greater customer choice pay more for it. They also say a greater electric choice leads to more volatile prices and less new investment. Some key backers of electric choice, including our next guests, have blasted this study, calling the findings unsubstantiated. The debate is important because next month the Snyder administration plans to finalize recommendations for the state's energy future. Whether to offer options to more Michigan electricity customers will be a key part of the legislative debate expected next year. To explain their criticism of the public sector report, we welcome back to Current State Mr. Wayne Kuipers, Executive Director of the group Energy Choice Now. Welcome back, Wayne.
Good morning.
And along with Wayne, Bob Nelson, an attorney and a Michigan Public Service Commissioner from 1999 to 2005. Bob Nelson, welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
You have roundly criticized the public sector consultant report for several reasons. One researcher you're working with went so far as to call it shameful yesterday. What's going on here exactly?
Well, I think they get an A for consistency. The problem is they're consistently wrong.
Okay.
The information they laid out in the report, which you highlighted in your opening comments, just can't be proven by facts.
Let's hear from Ken Sikkema of Public Sector Consultants. Here is what he said last week when I said that it seems counterintuitive that more choice doesn't translate into lower, more competitive prices.
What really drives rates is not whether you're at a regulated or a deregulated market. What really drives rates are structural aspects like the price of natural gas, which goes up and down. Michigan, in fact, for the first 8 years of this decade, 2000 to 2008, allowed what I would call 100% choice. But the fact of the matter is very few customers took advantage of that because the rates, natural gas rates, and the rates on the wholesale markets were very high.
Bob Nelson, let's get your response.
Yes,
to that.
Well, I think respectfully, Ken is wrong. We did have more than 20% of customers or the load of one of the utilities sign up for customer choice when we had that period. But it's an interesting, he talks about the volatility of the rates. Nothing is more volatile than Michigan rates. We were above the national average before we had choice. We went way below the national average when we had choice between 2000 and 2008. And now we're way above the national average in rates. And Michigan's rates have gone up 30% in 5 years. And two of the states that Ken cited, you know, Texas and Illinois, those rates have gone down in the last 5 years.
Hmm. Okay, so we've addressed the volatility claim. There are several others that you are refuting. They also you're also refuting claims that rates are higher in electric choice states.
Yeah, if I could comment, since 1997, when choice first came into this country, the rates in regulated states, the ones that continue to have regulation, have gone up 56% in that period, you know, cumulative increase.
Since 97.
Since 97. Okay. In that same period, the deregulated states have only gone up 35%, which is less than the rate of inflation.
Okay. Now, before we go any further, we should explain, you mentioned a couple of the states. The public sector study focused on three.
Right.
Three states, Illinois, New Jersey, and Texas. Can any of your disputes with their report be explained because they focused on those three states?
Well, yeah, they were selective. But at the same time, if you look at Texas and Illinois, as I said, those rates have gone down since 2008, mm-hmm. residential, commercial, industrial. Michigan's have gone up considerably, 30% overall, 44% for residential customers.
Okay. Thirdly, you maintain that in electric choice states, or they maintain that in electric choice states, there's less investment, specifically in new electricity generation. You're throwing the flag on that, too.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
You bet. In fact, the last time we had capacity built in the state of Michigan was when we were a choice state.
Mm-hmm.
That's the last time. And the utilities, as part of the 2008 debate, said, we're going to build a new plant, but we need some certainty in the market in order to build the new plant. Well, they were given the certainty by closing up the choice market, but the plant never materialized. And now we're having the debate again, and what does Consumers Energy do? They say, well, we want to build a new 750-megawatt plant because the demand is there and we need to mothball a couple of our coal-fired plants. So we need the certainty that we have under the current system in order to build the plant. The reality is, if we don't change the law, the plant's not going to get built.
Yeah, and just compare with Illinois again, which is one of the states that Mr. Sikkema cited. They've added 11,000 megawatts since they went to choice. We've only added a little over 4,000 of that, as Wayne said, was when we had choice.
Mm-hmm.
In the immediate aftermath of choice legislation, we added 4,000 megawatts of new load, and very little since that time.
We're talking with Wayne Kuipers of Energy Choice Now here in Michigan, which backs a greater electric choice and deregulation, along with Bob Nelson, who is a former Michigan Public Service Commissioner. Finally, the fourth issue here, financial integrity, that in electric choice states, utilities get lower bond ratings because they're higher credit risks. That was another claim of the public sector report.
Yeah, and our study that was released yesterday indicates that is not true at all, that states that have been deregulated still can go to the market and still have good credit ratings. And it's very comparable to Michigan and to other states that are still regulated.
What are our listeners supposed to make of an 0-for-4 rating in terms of the key points, according to the public sector report?
Well, it's a complicated issue, and I think most people don't spend the time or the energy looking at the facts. And when an organization's like public sector consultants or the utilities come out with reports that make these claims, people just take it as the gospel truth. The reality is what they're sharing is not truthful,
mm-hmm.
Okay? And so, you know, we believe the facts are on our side. The states that have gone to choice would argue we're correct.
One other point in that, if we were able to go to choice right now, there's 10,000 customers waiting to go to choice right now in Michigan. If they had the opportunity to get another supplier, they could save almost $2 billion, and they could invest that $2 billion in new jobs. We figured that at least 21,000 new jobs could be added each year if they could go to choice.
So a job creator and a cost cutter, in your view.
Absolutely.
Let's also clarify that let's get to this issue of electric choice as it already exists in Michigan, because that is part of the landscape. We are now called a hybrid state. Can you explain that, please, Wayne?
Sure. The hybrid means we're sort of dancing in both studios, okay? We have a 10% cap on choice, so 10% of the load statewide is allowed to shop for their electric energy. When we had the debate in 2008, I was on the Energy Committee in the Senate. And I remember the utilities saying, at the time we were at about 3% choice. They said, we don't see in the foreseeable future where we move and reach the 10% cap. Well, 12 months later, we were at the 10% cap in both service territories. And as Bob said, we now have demand in the queue, which means customers have signed a contract stating that when choice is expanded or when there's cap space, they want to take advantage of choice, we would almost go to 25% choice if we allowed the companies that are in the queue to take advantage of choice.
5 years ago, what arguments did they cite for the difficulty getting from 3% to 10%?
Well, the 3% really was a representative of the fact that there were a number of benefits from choice, you know, like a rate cut, for example, that residentials and commercial customers got, and so their rates were artificially deflated. And so suppliers didn't have an opportunity to come in right away. But as Wayne says, once you know, we're back to even a level playing field, then there's this demand for choice, and that's why you have 10,000 customers in the queue.
Has public sector responded to your report that you issued yesterday, Wayne?
No.
Okay. What kind of response do you expect?
Zero.
No response whatsoever.
No.
How confident are you, Wayne Kuipers, that Michigan will eventually offer more electric choice as a result of this upcoming debate?
Well, if you look at the facts, I mean, we've said all along, this is not a partisan issue. And in today's political scene, I think people are begging for legislative bodies to do something together, okay, where you don't have the partisan divide. Electrons don't know Republican or Democrat, okay? What we know in this state is our rates are too high. This is an issue where both sides can come together and say, we want to address this issue. We think it's good for job creation. Michigan still ranks fairly high, although our numbers are improving. We still rank fairly high nationally in our unemployment rate. And what we're starting to hear now from companies is, you want us to consider coming to Michigan? You know, you've done a lot with regulation, you've done a lot with business tax, but we can't compete because your rates are too high. And so they're either not going to come to Michigan, or those that are looking to expand who are already in Michigan are looking to expand in other states mm-hmm. where they can take advantage of lower electricity rates.
As a former legislator, now we've got an election in a year, so we will have Republican majorities at the state capitol for much of this debate in 2014. Politically, how does this play out in your view?
As much as those in the capitol right now think this is a politically dicey issue, my argument to them is, this is not a politically dicey issue. I mean, this, if you look at the facts and you look at where Michigan's at today and you look at where Michigan wants to be, you have to address this issue. It's okay. The next big thing.
Okay. We want to thank our guests. Wayne Kuipers is executive director of the group Energy Choice Now. Also, thanks to Bob Nelson, an attorney and a former Michigan Public Service Commissioner from 1999 to 2005. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Its current state here on 90.5 WKAR, the sounds of the Brooklyn-based duo Mahogany. They are in town to play the Broad Art Museum's first anniversary celebration, and we will talk with Andrew Prinz and Jacqueline Slim coming up in just a little bit here on Current State. Michigan State University's Broad Art Museum is indeed celebrating its first birthday with an event tonight called Global. Along with food, fashion, and art, there'll be live music by the aforementioned Mahogany, and it's been 1 year since the Broad opened. Since that opening, thousands of people have visited the museum to see not only contemporary art on display, but see the building itself. The Zaha Hadid design may always be controversial, but there's no denying the attention it has received. And we're going to take a look back at the Broad's first year and look ahead as well by welcoming back founding director Michael Rush. Happy birthday to the Broad, and nice to see you again,
well, thank
Michael.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. It's hard to believe we're a year old already.
It has flown. Let's start with some of the first-year numbers reported this week in the Lansing City Pulse. The Broad Art Museum has had more than 107,000 visitors. All 50 states have been represented. The District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, 80 countries. You've had 5,000 donors. You have 670 members. 335 artworks have been displayed, special events. How do those metrics play out
fantastic.
For
I
you?
I want to go to that museum.
You
got to
go check this out.
Yeah, you know, it's really been beyond our wildest expectations. We've now surpassed 110,000 in the last few days. And, you know, when I first came here a few years ago, the thing that struck me most about this wonderful university, MSU, and where the museum might fit in it, my feeling was that we wanted to become the cultural arm of this great global enterprise that really is MSU. Now, MSU doesn't go around building satellites all around the world, but MSU has a presence in almost every country around the world. And I said to myself, look, we want to reflect that global presence in our presentations and in our lively programs, exhibitions, and so forth. So I'm happy to report that, you know, that we're really delivering on our vision. We've had, as you mentioned, artists from all over the world, visitors from 80 countries, and on and on and on. It's, you know, I feel when I think about it, when I think about the response that we've had, you know, the enormous response from the public that we've had is sort of the hallmark of our not only our visibility here, but a recognition of the desire that so many people have to have us here. And it's just very heartwarming. You know, we're a global museum, yes, but we're on Grand Avenue in East Lansing, Michigan, and that's where our home is. And, you know, we talk about people from around the world visiting, but most people are regional visitors.
Anderson Economic Group, a study by them, did project 150,000 visitors. How attached to that number did you become?
Well, I didn't. You know, I take projections and all of that as, you know, as we should take them, you know, that these are best-case scenarios given the data that is there. So I feel, given our, you know, our relatively small numbers as a city, as an urban center, and given the fact that we are a contemporary art museum where there has not been a contemporary art museum, that we're sort of new, and the building is different, I think the fact that people have responded in such great numbers is really, really heartwarming.
How are visitor numbers tracked anyway? I mean, people can come and go without paying or speaking
to anyone.
They don't
pay. We have people with clickers. It's not terribly sophisticated. You know, people, you know, in my profession and in the museum world, we're always looking for ways to measure guests and who they are and where they come from and blah, blah, blah. But we do, you know, record the fact that of everybody who enters in the door, and then we take samplings of people, our visitor guides do, and ask them where they're from and how they heard about the museum. So we're really constantly working on how to update that to the 21st century. But, you know, we don't have tickets for admission and so forth, so there's no immediate data source for that kind of thing.
During your first year and even before opening, the Broad sponsored off-site events in places like Old Town Lansing and across Grand River from the museum and the former Barnes & Noble bookstore. Are more off-site events planned for the future?
We certainly hope to, yes. I mean, part of this is economics. You know, all the great things we're doing inside the museum have certain, you know, budgetary requirements, and we are absolutely in favor of and want to continue doing off-site projects. We'll be doing public art projects, which is sort of off-site, but those will be on the streets. And in terms of buildings, we had a great time in Old Town last year. Funding dependent, we would like to do some of those things again. Absolutely.
Numbers aside, Michael, what about the museum's reception from the wider art world, the national and international attention it got when it opened and in the past year?
Well, I'm very proud to say that I think we're on pretty much everybody's map. We, by virtue of the high visibility of our architect, our Pritzker Prize-winning architect, who's now doing projects, you know, everywhere around the world, Zaha is. And Eli Broad, our founding donor, he and his wife. You know, these two people alone are so broadly known in the international art world that their names bring a lot of recognition. And we have outreach, I mean, largely the world is knowing about us is because of the outreach and the collaborations that we're making. We're collaborating with foundations in Istanbul and Iraq, oddly, which I'd love to talk about if you have time, Brazil, all around many parts of the world where actually, with the exception of Iraq, the MSU already has a strong presence. And that's sort of the pattern that we're following. We want to establish international relationships in countries where MSU is particularly strong. I think that feeds us both ways. But in terms of, I mean, we're in the international press all the time. A German magazine just featured us, big story last week. We've been working with, I think this is important to say, we've been working with a very, well, with the top PR firm, museum PR firm in New York to spread our word around. I mean, I'm not the type of person who likes to keep good things hidden under a bushel. I want people to know about us. And as a global museum, I want the globe to know about us. Mm. So I think anywhere that I've traveled and navigated, people know who we are.
What can you tell us about the coming year? Are there artists you're looking forward to bringing our attention to, or artists you'd like to exhibit?
Well, one of the big things that we're doing this year, coming year, is that we have hired the first mainland Chinese curator of contemporary Chinese art in a U.S. museum, and he's organizing a very large museum occupying exhibition on contemporary Chinese art, and that's a very big deal for us. There'll be several contemporary Chinese artists represented. Several will come and visit and give talks and so forth. The curator's name is Chun Chen Wang. He's a really great guy. He's based in Beijing, but he spends part time with us. Our terrific curator, Allison Gass, has organized a group of shows called Global Focus, which features one artist, one from Iran and several other countries. And also, we'll be continuing this very interesting program of having significant artists, like the current person we have now is Hope Gangloff from Brooklyn, who is curating an exhibition using our collection. You know, we have a 7,500 object collection that we've inherited from the Kresge Art Museum.
Yes.
So we've invited these artists to curate exhibitions with their own work and with the artwork that's in our authority in our collections. And it's a really fantastic combination and mix and match and contextualizing of contemporary art in new ways. We've got some really terrific artists coming along.
Well, we want to congratulate you and everybody affiliated with the Broad Art Museum on your first birthday, first anniversary. A celebratory event tonight is called Global Food, Fashion, and Art. Michael Rush, founding director of the Broad Art Museum.
Tickets still available. Come on in.
Uh-oh. Thanks, Michael.
Okay, thank you.
Music coming to you live here this morning from Studio S at WKAR, provided by Mahogany. They are from Brooklyn. One member has roots here in the greater Lansing area, and we will talk with Andrew Prinz and Jacqueline Slim about their music a little bit later on this hour. They're performing at the Broad Art Museum's first anniversary celebration tonight. It's current state on WKAR. Our election 2013 coverage has examined the races for city council in Lansing and East Lansing, and a look at the Lansing ballot measure that would decriminalize marijuana. Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero was here this week to talk about his reelection campaign. Today we wrap up our coverage by talking with Mayor Bernero's opponent. Harold Lehman Jr. is a former member of the Lansing City Council, where he represented the city's first ward for 12 years. He was president of the council for the last 2 years he served, and then narrowly lost his seat on the council in 2007. Since then, he's lost races to regain the council seat and also campaigned for the Ingham County Board of Commissioners as well as for the State House. In August, however, he finished second in the primary election behind Bernero and thus won the right to challenge the mayor. Harold Lehman, welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
We've been opening our segments with the following question, and I'll ask you as well. If you're elected, what single challenge facing the city would you most like to help solve, and why?
Well, first and foremost, I would... There's not one issue. There's many. Your responsibility is to always to have a balanced budget and to get that through every year, and to deal also with long-term costs to the city. I'm talking retirement, health care, those kind of issues. And then I would get to the bottom line, which is dealing with a lot of neighborhood issues. Over the past 8 years, they have been neglected, and residents get to the point where they wonder, when will the city come out and take care of a tree, take care of a sidewalk, pave my street? Because I was on council for 12 years, you know how to deal with people, you know how to deal with a bureaucracy, you know how to get things done. And, you know, I give the current mayor a lot of credit for the downtown issues that have been resolved to some degree regarding development. But at the end of the day, citizens are wondering, when are we going to get some things done in the neighborhoods? And
you're that guy. You're the neighborhood candidate.
And I'm that guy.
The administration's had to deal with a great recession, though, too, which hit cities and right. neighborhoods especially hard. Do you cut them any slack on that account?
I do, but at the end of the day, you know, the current mayor never was raised here in Lansing. He came to work in state government and then started his career as a state, as a county commissioner and a state rep and then a state senator for less than 4 years, and ran a seat that Tony Benavides had, trying to fill it after Dave Hollister went to state government. So at the end of the day, a lot of people, and they've told me over and over, they appreciate what the mayor has done, but it's time that we have new leadership, a new direction, and they're just tired of everything his way or the highway, not being able to get along with council members, getting to the point where the friction has built up, there are things don't get done, and he diverts attention to the point where he blames everybody else except himself. And he will admit that he is going to not change. He wants to change the council. And it's my belief that things are not going to really change on council. They're throwing everything they can at the current incumbent. But at the end of the day, people see through that, and they don't want a dictatorship continuing in Lansing. They want people to get along and to move the city forward and not be afraid to speak out.
Mayor Bernero visited Current State here 2 days ago, and we played for him some of your comments about Lansing neighborhoods that you made to the Lansing State Journal. Here is how he responded.
We've put something like $30 million into the neighborhoods through the Neighborhood Stabilization Program with President Obama, and we've worked cooperatively with the treasurer, the county treasurer, the land bank. We have done absolute historic. We have moved mountains in our neighborhoods. Now, are they challenged? Absolutely, and Harold knows this. I mean, any aging city has aging infrastructure and aging housing stock. It is a challenge. But you know the number one thing we can do for our neighborhoods, Mark? Of course, I don't run the schools. That could affect them. But the number one thing I can do as mayor is to bring jobs to the city.
So you would contend with his claim that he's moved mountains in the neighborhood, but the mayor and his supporters do tout his job creation record.
And I would just say that if people would look at the record, it took a lot of people to get to the point where Chevrolet will come to Lansing. You know, Harold Lehman was there in 1996 on the fifth and deciding vote to give an abatement to General Motors. The UAW was there supporting it. Dave Hollister is wishing, hoping that we could send a message to GM, please come reinvest in Lansing. And there were five council members, Tony Benavides, Rick Lilly, Sandy Allen, Joan Bauer, and Harold Lehman, that voted 5-3 to give the abatement back in 96 that started the ball rolling to show General Motors that we want them to stay here and to continue to build plants here. Virge Bernero was not on the scene back then. He had no interest in city government. Harold Lehman stepped to the plate and got it done. And people forget that other council members, other administrations, get things in place so that a person like the current mayor can take credit for it, but he always forgets that it didn't happen under his watch. A lot of things occurred before then. And so we have the Cadillac plant. We have the Delta plant. We're going to get Chevrolet here. So this is what I'm trying to get across to people. A lot of people had to do a lot of things, whether it be the growth of Old Town, the growth of Rio Town. But at the end of the day, you have to have a mayor that deals with all kinds of people and issues and not make it personal. And he takes everything personal if you disagree with him. And this is why Harold Lehman is running for mayor, to try to get the citizens to make sure that they know that they have somebody in City Hall that has an open door, that is not afraid to listen to them, and to have the press come in and investigate anything. You know, we have an internal auditor, the auditor for the city council, that is new and has put out a finding. And what does the administration do? Well, they're anti toward this what's going on, and they say it's all political. But the reality is we need to have more investigations of what's going on the last 8 years and to support the council and their auditor on getting to the bottom of things instead of having attention diverted to something else, because he's good at always diverting attention and not making sure that those people that are asking the questions get their answers and to move on.
We're talking with Harold Lehman, candidate for mayor of Lansing. You're on record opposing the ballot proposal that would decriminalize small amounts of marijuana in Lansing. But a recent poll for the first time shows 58% of Americans now favor legalization. Why do you oppose the measure?
Well, it all goes back to this whole issue of, was it in 2008, the ballot proposal, and all the things that had to be done afterwards to get that implemented, and the fact that at the end of the day, the federal government is not going to back off on this whole marijuana issue. You can say whatever you want about what people have said during campaigns, but when I see the federal government not backing off on this whole issue of marijuana, and they get people in serious trouble, people that have been written about in the city pulse, the State Journal, having to go spend time in prison because they didn't understand the feds were not going to back off. And I think this is just another diversion from, and let's deal with issues in the city, such as getting these roads repaired, getting the sidewalks, not having to wait over 2 years to get a tree either trimmed or taken down because it's dead. Instead of having issues diverted to talk about that, you know, people have said, I think it's a no-brainer. If people vote for it, it doesn't mean anything. So let's stay focused on getting the city to be looking better, getting these corridors, corridors into the city of Lansing throughout the region looking better. And I'm just staying focused on trying to get the city and the basic services implemented so that people are proud to say this is the capital city of Lansing.
You haven't raised much money. You haven't spent much money Virge Bernero hasn't had to spend much money as a result. We can't find a Lehman campaign website. What are you doing to win this race? How seriously are you taking this?
Well, you know, it's the negativity that is always out there regarding someone challenging the person in office. You know, I waited to see who else was going to run. Nobody had any municipal experience, and I didn't think it was right for the citizens of Lansing to have a long opportunity of from May to November to have somebody get a free ride, such as the current mayor. And, you know, I'm proud of the fact that I've been in this town all my life, 55 years. I'm proud of the fact that I've run for office. I started in 87. I've won some. I've lost some. But for people to continue to bring up negative issues regarding, well, you lost that general election or you lost that primary. Well, I've won more than I've lost. And so, you know, you say what you can regarding, well, you don't have this or you don't have that. At the end of the day, you do what you can to give people a chance to look at the candidates. And, you know, why doesn't the media follow up on all the money that has been raised by Virge Bernero?
Okay.
It's called pay to play, and it's all coming to a head in certain pieces of mailings that others are involved in. And so we need to make sure we focus on how much money Virge Bernero has been getting and what does he do for people that give him that kind of money.
Okay, we got to leave it there. Harold Lehman Jr. is a former member of the city council in Lansing, where he represented the first ward for 12 years. Good luck, Harold. We commend you for your willingness to serve.
Thank you very much.
Into the end zone for a touchdown goes Keith Mumphrey. Touchdown, MSU. The long bomb, Connor Cook to Keith Mumphrey for a 47-yard score.
Well, college tradition and a possible Big Ten football championship come together this weekend here in East Lansing as the Spartans take on the Wolverines tomorrow. WKAR's Peter Wharf talks with Oakland, California-based freelance writer Nathan Coca about football tradition, pageantry, and his Yahoo.com article, The Top 25 Best Fight Songs in College Football.
You know, when I think of college football, I think of, like, something that really brings together the entire, like, university community, not just, like, in the city where the college is, but all around the world. And the fight song is kind of, like, the symbol of that unity. And there's something different about college football. The stadiums are, you know, the largest stadiums in America. And most stadiums is not necessarily about, you know, where you sit. You can be sitting in the back, you can be sitting in the front, but you get the same sort of experience. You get the same sort of feel. You get the same sort of connection to the game and to the sport. You know, you always want to have the students closer because they provide the energy. And I think the whole stadium feeds off the energy and the marching band and really provides that spark. And I think that keeps everything together.
And in your Yahoo article, you touch a little bit on the difference between college football and professional football, whereas in professional football, there's certainly plenty of energy and sound, some might say noise, but it doesn't have quite the same pageantry.
I definitely agree with that, and I'm also an NFL fan. I definitely prefer college. When I go to an NFL game, it's fun, but I feel like I can get a similar experience to watching it on TV. But going to a college game, and watching a college game on TV, I think are just two completely different experiences. And just being there in the stadium and seeing the pageantry and seeing the band and just being part of the whole experience and the energy, I think it's something really, really special.
Flutie flushed. Throws it down. Caught by Boston College. I don't believe it. Oh. It's a touchdown. The Eagles win it.
Nithin, take me back to when you were younger and your first college fight song or fight songs. Do you remember the one or the ones that you first heard and that stirred you?
No, I know it shouldn't be such a big thing, but you know, having a good sports program was actually important to me because I felt like it would be part of the college experience and help me connect more to where I was going.
Absolutely. So, Nithin, take me to your days at USC. Certainly, some might call that one of the more relentless fight songs.
Yeah, I know our opposing fans often will complain that we play it too often or play it over and over again. And that's a funny thing because I don't think any USC fan will ever get sick of hearing that song. We can play it over and over again. We can hear it on repeat for hours, and you know, we still love it.
Your list is entitled The Top 25 Best Fight Songs in College Football. So, okay, Nithin, let's break this down a bit. Your list includes a group of 20 made up of, you know, some of the ones that you would expect. Looks like, if I'm correct, 6 from the Big Ten, 7 from the SEC. The Pac-10 is represented by 4 great schools and great fight songs, and the Big 12 has a few as well. Let's break this down just a little bit into some of the common qualities. What makes for a great fight song as it appears on your list?
When I was making this list, I was really looking at like a few things. Number one is like recognizability, like which are the songs like that we recognize across the country as being powerful fight songs. And second, ones that really like within the song have that energy or really represent the university, represent the fan base. Yeah, and I really tried hard to get a geographic, you know, pick schools from all the different parts of the country. Do the typical fan who goes to the university knows the words of the song or they know what to do when the song is going, when the song is happening. And obviously, yeah, you know, there's certain songs that we all heard. I think around here, like the Michigan fight song is so pervasive. I think when I heard it, I'm like, wow, I think I've heard, I can't remember. I feel like I heard this song when I was growing up, even though I maybe wasn't a Michigan fan. But it's just so, you hear it everywhere. Everyone knows it. Same with Notre Dame. Everyone knows So Come Horn, Boomer Sooner. There's a lot of these songs are part of our collective national culture.
What is it, I have to ask, that made you include Michigan State on your list?
They've had a team that's competed well, you know, in the last several years, and I think it's added to the atmosphere, and then that's why I knew the song when I heard it. Yeah, I'm assuming that's why I put it on there.
Let's go up the list a little bit. Of course, you mentioned Notre Dame before. You have them as your number 3 choice. Michigan, as you astutely noted, is a fight song, the victors, that is known across the country by every college football fan. But then your number 1 pick to me at the same time was somewhat of a surprising pick, but a delightful and admirable one as well. You have Army and Navy tied for number 1. Really anthems, as you said, not just fight songs.
You know, the Navy-Army song, the Navy-Army game every year is just, it's known across the country as being the purest, most traditional rivalry in the country, a place where the traditions have been the same, where it doesn't matter how good the schools are or how good they're playing. The stadium's going to be full, the energy's going to be there, people all across the country are going to cheer. And the fact that even though they're a rivalry, I don't think you never have fans from the other team disrespecting the other team's fight song. You know, it's something that everyone collectively cheering for, everyone collectively has an energy. And these are also 2 fight songs that we've all heard in some form. We've heard it maybe when we saw like the 4th of July march, or maybe we heard it on Memorial Day or some sort of event. It's also been part of like who we are as a country. You know these kids that are playing for the universities, they're all gonna go serve for our country, and they're doing this, you know, they're not recruited the same way that people in Michigan, Notre Dame, or USC are. They are doing this more for the pure love of football. And this game represents that, I think, you know, original idea of what makes college football really special.
Nithin Coca is a freelance writer in Oakland, California. His recent article, The Top 25 Best Fight Songs in College Football, was the topic of our discussion today. Nithin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Worth.
On to the fray, I know.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm your host, Mark Bayshore. The duo Mahogany has been playing for us all hour here today. They're based in Brooklyn. They are in East Lansing, as we've mentioned, to play for the Broad Art Museum's first anniversary celebration tonight. We welcome to the Current State microphones Jacqueline Slim and Andrew Prinz. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
It's
Thank
been
you.
Really special to hear your music this morning performed live. On the radio. How long have you two been making music together?
About 3 years now.
Yeah.
Okay. How'd you meet?
We met in Philadelphia through a photographer, and Andrew was working between New York and Philadelphia, and that's kind of how we started working on music together and film.
And it's all music now. I know you've got all kinds of things. Both of you seem to have all kinds of things going on in addition to music. Is it mostly music at this point?
It seems like it. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We settled down on that a bit.
Totally.
How would you describe your music? I know you've been called art pop, mm-hmm. space rock. Shoegaze? That's the first time I've ever heard shoegaze. What does shoegaze mean?
Well, shoegaze came out of England in the early 90s, and it was...
Blame it on England.
It was...
Blame it on England.
It was sort of like modern psychedelic music.
Okay.
And a lot of groups in the U.S. picked up on it. Here in Michigan, we had a record label in Detroit who was known for doing space rock, and that was sort of the domestic equivalent.
Okay. You've been called everything but klezmer, really, what it boils down to. But there's real texture to what you do. I think it's real textural, and there's a real complexity to it as well.
I grew up playing cello and ended up in the composition program at Michigan State, and then moved into graphic design and some other things related, like photography and such. So all of those things play a role in the music, which is kind of architected, and it's very composed. I sit down with the paper and notate everything out, and it's pretty articulated.
Wow, very interesting. You attended Waverly High School.
I did.
Studied graphic design and music here at Michigan State. What was the music environment for you? How did you respond to the musical environment in and around East Lansing while you were growing up?
Well, at the time, grunge was really big on the radio. I had groups like Nirvana and Stone Temple Pilots, and I think that what we were thinking of was more of the stuff that we'd heard from across the pond. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was a bit more pastoral, and maybe it had more connection to the things that we saw in our suburban and sort of country environment around here. So that found resonance with us, and that was kind of where we began.
Jacqueline, you have a background in dance. How did you transition into making music?
Well, I grew up as a ballerina, so when I met Andrew, he suggested that I start working with instruments. And so it actually translated really well to go from feet mathematics and articulation into hand movement. Mm. So, and also the background of working with music, dancing with music. So it's kind of the same sort of brain waves that I'm working with.
Explain where the sounds came from that our listeners heard this morning. I sat here in the studio and I watched both of you play 12-string electric guitars, but our listeners heard an awful lot more than that. Andrew, Can you explain what it was they heard?
Well, there's a lot of production that goes into the tracks. So we have, rhythm boxes, samplers. We will spend some time in the studio working with the aforementioned cello. And then we'll bring it all together in some software programs that also give us synthesizer noises and these kinds of things. And so those amalgamations are kind of based on a lot of the music theory that I had gotten into with 20th century composers like Steve Reich or Jorge Ligeti. Even people like Debussy and Ravel are really important to me.
What goes into making a record for you guys? Andrew, you're a designer as well. Mm-hmm. You have this unusual enthusiasm. Sorry, I shouldn't call it unusual. You have an enthusiasm for more efficient transportation, which became the theme of your last album called Connectivity. What goes into making a record?
I think a lot of discussion with people that I know on the way here from New York. In fact, I was in Philadelphia to meet with a client, and then ran into a friend of mine, my friend Stephen Gardner, who is the president of the Northeast Corridor of Amtrak. And so I speak with him at times about what's going on there. We have $40 billion that Obama earmarked for things like high-speed rail development and regional rail development. And I think that album you mentioned, the connectivity record, became sort of a manifesto of sorts in terms of how we could envision what the future would look like if we had an integrated transportation network with light rail, interurban, and these kinds of things, that it's just sort of a more of a benign state of transportation.
And Jacqueline, you're on board with some of these themes too. So
when I met Andrew, I was doing the New Phil York Adelphia route, as we like to call it. So going between Philadelphia and New York to work, to play, whatever. So yeah, of course I'm on board.
Well, I'll tell you, it's been fascinating to have you here today. You're going to play us out with a particular song. Tell us what our listeners are going to hear.
Well, this song is actually about bicycles. It's called Resistance and Release. And there's those critical mass rides that people have when everybody gets together and goes down the street. And I find those moments to be particularly exuberant. My brother, who also went to Michigan State here, works for the East Bay Bicycle Coalition in San Francisco. So we all like to get involved with bringing new stuff to the table.
Why don't you make your way over and get strapped on and plugged in here again. Mahogany performs tonight at the first anniversary celebration of the Broad Art Museum. Andrew Prinz went to Waverly High School, and his partner Jacqueline is the other member of Mahogany, and we are about to hear Resistance and Release from Mahogany. Mahogany, live in Studio S here from WKAR. Jacqueline Slim and Andrew Prinz in East Lansing this weekend. Many thanks for their musical contribution to Current State today. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us for Current State here on WKAR.